took an Uber here and the driver said, I think we can all agree, Donald Trump looks great for his age. I got concerned because a blind man was driving this car.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and today on the show is Amanda Seales. Amanda has a fascinating story, from starting out as a child actor to becoming a spoken word poet and MTV VJ under the name Amanda Diva, to her current career as a stand-up comedian and co-star of the HBO show Insecure. She plays Tiffany. Now, Amanda has written a new book called Small Doses, Potent Truths for Everyday Use, that's available now. It's kind of an extension of her popular podcast, also called Small Doses, which, just like The Last Laugh, is part of the Starburns podcast network. Just one thing I want to note about this episode. We reference an incident that went down last month when Seales was kicked out of an After Emmys party hosted by her Insecure co-star Issa Rae's longtime publicist. If you want the full story on that, I suggest you listen to the episode of Amanda's podcast called Side Effects of Professionalism, Part 1. But we get into it a little bit more on this episode as well. Did you know that The Last Laugh has its own Instagram account? We would love for you to give it a follow at Last Laugh Pod, where you can see photos from tapings and find out who's coming up on the show. Please check that out at Last Laugh Pod. And now, Amanda Seales. Yeah, you were saying you don't... Where do you record your podcast?
At my house.
At your house. Nice. Mm-hmm. Do you have a studio in your house?
No.
Or a little makeshift studio?
I just have like this like back room that apparently is good for sound dampening.
Yeah.
But it just makes it easier schedule-wise. Mm-hmm. Like we... go there. And also, like, the vibe.
Yeah.
I think I prefer just, like, the relaxness of the house versus, like, the studio for my particular podcast, because then people get very comfortable and they get very open.
Yeah, but sometimes you don't even have a guest and you're just talking into the mic. And then is there anyone else in the room when you do that, or is it just you?
Yeah, the engineer and the producer.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, Rebecca is, like, this, like, silent... cast member on the show.
Yeah.
Like, everyone hears me always be like, Rebecca! And they're like, I want to see what Rebecca looks like. Because Rebecca's on the side just making faces.
Yeah. So I actually saw you perform last night at the benefit. I thought you would appreciate this. They invited me to come see, and I was like, yeah, I'm interviewing her the next day. I should come check it out. It was an interesting show. How did that go for you? It's the IMF, the International Myeloma Foundation benefit.
I mean, whenever I'm in those situations, I am expected to make white people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I'm the only black person that is there on the bill. It's a bunch of straight white guys and Carolyn Ray.
Yeah.
So I'm just playing my role.
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't expect me to come here and do jokes about mustard.
Yeah, there was one moment that I really loved where someone in the back, a guy, just shouted out, I love white girl. Yeah.
But what you don't know is that I got a DM shortly thereafter from a black woman who was sitting at his table.
Oh, really?
And she was like, I hope that the heckler in the back did not throw you off, because when you said that you were exposing racists, a number of people in our section were visibly affected by that. And she was like, but thank you for being the voice in the room, because oftentimes I am the only black person in the room, mm-hmm. and it just feels like I don't get to have that voice. And by the way... She was like, I knew he was racist because when I sat down, he said, oh, are you here from a prison release program?
What?
White people, y'all don't understand the shit that other white people are saying to us. Like,
yeah, that is insane.
She said that that's how he greeted her. And then he was like, just joking. And she had to sit there at the table with him. So she was like, thank you, because you made it worthwhile.
Yeah, this was the second time that I saw you perform for a predominantly white audience, because I also was at the Greek theater.
Oh, you've seen my greatest
for Crooked Media, the Pod Save America live show.
Audience, though.
That was a fun show.
Yes, it was fun. And also, like, you know, I always say, like, there's people who are white and there's people who happen to be white. Like, the happen to be white audience is laughing with you.
Yeah.
Because they're like, yeah, they're annoying us, too. You know, so they're like, yeah, the privileged folks are bothering us too. So speak on it.
Yeah.
But I was also just very happy to like get to be there with like Dimitri Martin and Patton. And like,
yeah,
that's
one of the funniest.
That's one of the funniest green rooms I've ever been in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Ray Romano was hosting.
Yes.
He's good.
All we needed was Seinfeld, and I would have just cried.
Yeah.
I would have cried. Yeah.
I want to talk about your book.
Oh, yeah.
Small Doses. It's when this podcast drops, it'll be out. And I got an early copy of it, and got to go through it, and it's It's a really great project, and there's so much fun stuff in there and advice. And so how did you kind of decide that it's kind of an extension of your podcast, which is also mm-hmm. Small Doses. So how did you decide that you wanted to kind of expand your podcast into a book?
Honestly, like the listenership was really encouraging of like, we would like to see the words you're saying on the page. We'd want to resource it. And it just, I knew that I wanted to do a book that could do a number of things. Like I just didn't want to do just essays.
Mm-hmm.
And from doing Small Doses, like it offered me kind of like this space where I could like say little thoughts and big thoughts and mm-hmm. stories. And so it just kind of intermingled with that. And then once I was with Abrams, I had pitched it with like doodles involved because I just mm-hmm. wanted to have something that's like multimedia.
Yeah.
But Abrams like specializes in like books that have art involved. And so they really like did a great job with the layout and with just intermingling my drawings and my images and making it seem seamless versus just like, here's Amanda's brain vomiting mm-hmm. in a bound book.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's definitely like different aspects to it because there's your personal stories throughout and then kind of more specific like advice to people.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you, and I think there are some stories that you talk about in your stand-up that are also in the book, but mm-hmm. you kind of expand on them. So how is it different from writing stand-up versus writing it for a book?
Well, I don't write my stand-up. Like, oh. I don't write it down.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in my head. So when I sat down to write it, it's like, oh, okay, I have to like carry the tonality that I have when I say it to the page.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you find out if you're a good writer.
Yeah.
So you guys will be the judge of that. Because I want people to be able to read it and hear my voice, whether it's in a recording or not, you know? And I want, mm-hmm. in order to do that, I have to like color it with certain, you know, literary devices, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of metaphor and foreshadowing and all the stuff that Mrs. Poirot at Dr. Phillips High School drilled into my head. Alliteration, metaphor, analogy, foreshadowing, verisimilitude, which I stay away from because I am a truth teller,
yeah,
et cetera. So those things, you just never know where what you learn is going to come.
Yeah, you
in.
Found that stuff kind of coming up when you were writing?
Not even kind of, like 1,000,000%. Like Ms. Poirot was in the room with me like, nope, do better. Nope. And, you know, I'm not just a perfectionist, but I'm somebody that just wants to make something that people like, you mm-hmm. know, and I know the things that make me like things. And I love when I read things and it's very vivid and, you know, when the language is just clear and colorful. And even when I write scripts, like my stage directions are very detailed because mm-hmm. I want you to see what I saw when I envisioned this.
Mm-hmm. So is this, I mean, there's so much advice for people who are, might be coming up in the entertainment industry. And so I was wondering, is this the kind of book that you wish you had had when you were coming up and starting out, to learn, cause it's all stuff that you've learned from experience.
Yeah.
But do you think if you had had a book like this, how would that have changed your experience?
I mean, I just think so much of it is just like a loneliness. You know, you just kind of feel like even though there's all these other creatives, you're the only one
mm.
who's grappling with these challenges,
yeah.
you know? So I think just being able to see like that someone else has experienced it and that not only is this person addressing it, but there's enough people that are experiencing it for them to feel comfortable like addressing it in a book versus just as like a question answer section
mm-hmm.
Can bring some people some comfort and just... I know for me, like, I would have appreciated this type of book because I think it would have just kind of given me a little bit more peace in the process. And, you know, we all talk about process and the artistic process, and there's things that come along with that that you need. But there's also stuff that I feel like I kind of didn't need. You know, there was a mm-hmm. there was a certain level of unnecessary stress.
Like what?
Just the idea of like, will people like this? Like, how do I get people to like this? Am I enough? You know, like you ask those questions, but then when you kind of don't have anything to bounce that against, you can ruminate on it into a point of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where a lot of artists like end up when they don't have something to guide them. That's why we end up having like these workbooks. Like, what's the art workbook that everyone, the artist workbook everyone does? Someone's literally in their house right now yelling it at this device they're listening to this on.
I'm like, a coloring book? What
no,
are we talking about?
It's like, it's a workbook. It's like the artist's journey or something like that, that everyone has. Mm. I have it. I just forgot.
I do not have it.
But there's also like just the reason why like people listen to so many artist podcasts. The reason why, you know, there's a particular video that Ira Glass has, a particular like talk that he did that someone made into a Word video that is on YouTube called Taste.
Okay.
And someone sent me that one day, and I'm telling you, it alleviated my anxiety for like a good 6 months.
What did you learn from that video?
I learned from that video the importance of understanding that like this whole artistic process is not always going to make sense. And sometimes when it's not making sense, that's actually a good time. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us who are like perfectionists or just very like type A about things, like when things are nonsensical, it can feel just like really paradoxical. It feels like the universe is gaslighting you. And that's when people start getting to a dark place.
Yeah. Is there a moment in your career that you're thinking about when you think about being gaslit by?
Right now.
Yeah, right now, actually.
But if we're being frank.
Right now, in what sense?
I've just got a lot going on, bro. Just got a lot going on. And I think that there's just a certain like, you think that when you get to a certain space that things are going to be a certain way and they're not that way. And you're like, oh, and we've all had that, like with the crush that you thought was going to be dope. And then you get with them and you're like, oh, you don't know what apartheid is. Or true story. Like, or whether it's like, you know, getting into a certain program or getting a certain job or, you know, we've all, getting a meal. You know, we've all had that meal that we really looked forward to and then it arrived and you were like, oh, this actually doesn't, this actually tastes like peanut butter and feet. I'm going to say that. So I think, you know, for me, like this has been a very like interesting year of like a lot of like success on one hand and then a lot of like on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And so you're just, the other part of this is that as an artist, like you're kind of, you have to anticipate that those spaces are going to come. But as you get older, you try to get better about understanding those spaces. And when you have a resource like this book, I think it makes it easier.
I mean, are you talking at all about sort of the way the media covers
you?
Is there anything that you want to talk about in that sense or any frustrations that you have that you want to get out?
No, I think that the media has become like very disseminated into like different spaces, and some spaces are a lot more reliant on facts than others. And I just wish that was something that was more heralded and also more listened to by, I think there's a space as listener, as viewers, as an audience now, where we've come to kind of blur the lines between like facts-based media and like, I guess like gossip or clickbait media.
Yeah.
And when we don't distinctly discern the difference between like what's news and what's rumor, it gets really dangerous.
Yeah.
So I think for me, like a lot of the stuff that ends up getting, I think there's like a very blurred line between like the things about me that are like fact and news and the things about me that are just like someone either having an opinion or someone literally just making up a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, as I was researching for this and Googling you and reading about you and all that, you know, a lot of what's coming up now is about that after party at the Emmys.
Which is irrelevant.
And that's,
but
I mean, I don't know if that's what you were kind of alluding to in this, because that's been, I mean, a lot of the art, there's a lot of articles about it.
There's a journey that this year has gone on just by way of being a visible person. Right. So like the more visible you are, the more people there are that see you and the more opportunity there is for you to get rained on, you know? So I think that I get like very, I think I get really like positive stuff that gets written about me. And I think I touch people in a lot of positive ways.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of times like there's just a thirst for conflict that we are definitely like involved in our current state of the world.
Yeah.
And I have a demeanor that quenches that thirst.
Yeah, I mean, it's the double-edged sword of fame, though, right? It's like you, the more attention you get, the more positive attention you get, the more negative attention you get.
Yeah, I mean, Yes, I think that's why. And if anyone who knows me and anyone who reads this book will understand, like, why I just detest fame. Like, it's just it's a byproduct of working hard and in an industry that relies on visibility to enhance your clout, your access, your options, you know? And the thing about fame and celebrity is that so much of it is out of your control. And as a type A personality, side effects of type A personality is also featured in my book. Being outside, like not being able to control like a narrative or just like the way that you are perceived is very disconcerting. And it's not, for me, it was not a light switch flip to realize like, oh, you know, you no longer have control of your narrative, right? Like, it's taken me an entire year to truly understand, like, you know, you no longer have control of your narrative. I know you think you do because you have an Instagram, but that is incorrect.
Instagram and the book and the podcast are all kind of, I mean, I would imagine, are you trying to, you know, make your own narrative, right?
Yeah, 1000%. And I think that's also just like a natural trajectory, especially like as a Black person, like I have always rooted myself in a space of like wanting to tell our own stories. And so I want to tell my own story and I want to be able to, you know, be a space to relay the stories of others who may not want to or may not be able to or may not have access to tell their own stories, right? So it's important to me to be able to do that. It's just I wish we had more of a safer space to do that in.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about your story because it's fascinating and really unique. Sort of how you got to where you are. So you were born in LA, but then moved to Florida pretty at a young age, right?
I was born here till I lived here till I was eight. Then I moved to Orlando.
Was that a hard transition?
I don't know if it was hard per se, but I definitely had like things to say about it. I distinctly remember telling my mom like. I just remember telling my mom, like, this is so boring here. It's just boring. Like, there's no cars don't pass by. Like, you know, what are we doing? And then as an adult, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm so glad how boring it was. Thank you, Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I know you started acting at a pretty young age. So was that an attempt to get back to L.A. or to
I didn't even act in L.A. Like, I was, and I mean, you know, L.A. is... There's like Hollywood and then I mean, I lived in the valley, like deep in the valley. So like I wasn't like Hollywood adjacent by any means.
When you were a kid, you mean, or later?
I was a kid. But when I was in Orlando, like Orlando had become like a very kind of like bustling place for children's particular programming because Nickelodeon had built a studio and I lived 5 minutes from there. So, you know, that was something that was kind of just being put out there into the zeitgeist. And so my mom had me audition for like a Disney dance show one Saturday. And I was just, I just remember being like, you just want me to go for you. I don't know where I got that from. My mother is not a momager by any means, but it seemed like a thing to say. And she was like, oh, no, man, let's just go. Let's just go. And so we went and I ended up like getting a call back. And later that day, like I got picked to be a part of the Sparkling Christmas Spectacular. So I danced in front of Disney for Christmas, three shows a day for 3 weeks.
That was the first gig?
Yeah, at eight years old. Three shows a day, three weeks, including Christmas. That was also my first time experiencing racism. So it was, you know, I have these juxtaposed experiences with like good things and then like real things.
What
like,
was
that's
the,
like a
what was the
thing.
Racism you experienced as an 8 year old in Disney?
Well, I was the only, I was the only Black child in that particular cast of Sparkling Christmas Spectacular, and all of the other children, not all, that's not fair, but several of the other children out of the 10 of us made it very clear to me that I was only picked because I was Black and I should not consider myself a good dancer. I should not consider myself worthy of the position. And they made that very clear through their words, through their actions. When I was, I remember, you know, we're in therapy now. I remember in my... I remember my Secret Santa, you know, you had to give a gift for Secret Santa. And my Secret Santa gave me a half-eaten tube of candy with the top off. And he threw it at me and was like, Merry Christmas. So, you know, I get pegged as this, like, person who's a, like, you just want the smoke. And you're a, you know, I was told the other day someone said I was a vigilante. And I think what it really is that from an early age, I was singled out by means that I had no control over and made to feel like I didn't count. And so, like, I literally have a picture of, like, this group and, like, me in the back of a picture, like, with my face getting smushed because someone is, like, literally, like, pushing me out. And my therapist was like, this is the day.
Yeah.
This is the day you became the adult you are. And I don't think she's wrong. I'm not a vigilante. I'm a crusader. And I think that that type of person doesn't necessarily get understood much in this type of climate.
Mm-hmm. So
great.
So
you, what was that? Mm-hmm.
I think you're right.
Oh, okay.
No,
I was like, I want to hear more of what's behind that. Mm-hmm. Cause when my mom be saying, mm-hmm, I'm like, whoa, tell me more. And she's
I think you're right. So you start in the Disney stuff. You end up on a Nickelodeon show. My Brother and Me.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? Any better than the Disney experience?
Yeah, My Brother and Me was fun. It was, well, I was older too. I was 12. Mm. You know, so I kind of just had a more handle on like the environment of things. My Brother and Me was on Nickelodeon's set on their lot. I remember we shot across from Gullah Gullah Island and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first black sitcom on Nickelodeon. And it was just a fun experience just because I hadn't gotten to make TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd done like commercials.
Yeah.
But I didn't get to make TV. So it was really fun just getting to be in that space and table reads and blocking and shoot days and all of those things were learning experiences that I still carry with me to this day.
Yeah. So how did you kind of get from there to eventually you got into becoming a VJ,
mm-hmm,
and doing some more like music and poetry stuff? So what was that transition like, and kind of when did you start getting into that world?
Well, when I went to school, I went to SUNY Purchase, mm-hmm, in New York. And SUNY Purchase is a liberal arts college, but it has an acting, it was a theater and Performing Arts Conservatory and Music Conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's full of artists and creatives. And so when I went to Purchase as an acting major, I was just really just dropped into the mix of a bunch of folks that just loved their craft. And because they had because it was like a commuter school, it's a state school, so there was a lot of New Yorkers. Mm-hmm. And I think that that also changed things for me too, because they just seemed to have like more access to, mm-hmm, to their craft. And like hip hop for New Yorkers was not just music, it was a culture.
Yeah.
You know, and I really just dove into that. And I remember we had to do this like talent show kind of thing, like at the beginning of the semester, like, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I just remember like this kid in my class did a poem and I was like, that's an option. Like doing a poem, mm-hmm, because it wasn't like, you know, a Robert Frost poem, you, yeah, know, it was what we know now as spoken word, but yeah, I had never experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember up until that point, I had started writing raps because a friend of mine was like, have you ever tried rapping? And I was like, no. He's like, you should try it. You have a good voice. Mm-hmm. So I'd write all my raps as the fourth member of the Fugees.
Mm-hmm.
So I have like a whole rhyme book full of just like fourth verses to all Fugees records. And then, but when I saw this guy, Robert, do a spoken word piece, I was like, oh. Because the thing is that I could write raps, but I couldn't rap them on beat. Mm-hmm. This was a great, great struggle for me. Like, this was very seriously an issue. And when I saw Robert do spoken word, it was like, oh, that's where I fit, because, mm-hmm, that's where my language I can set the beat,
yeah,
you know. And I think that's like a common trend for me, like just wanting me to like march to my own beat, set my own beat,
mm-hmm,
and I think that that started early on in my life. But like once I got to school and started doing spoken word and getting into that space, like it was so exciting to be able to just do that.
I wanted to write some hot shit. Some blow off the rooftop shit. Some get you in your gut, take uninspired riders out they rut shit. Some makes Downton Cat say, yo, B, shorty could spit shit. Some so influential they call it the newest testament shit. Some waging war shit, make you go to your shoebox and get your gun shit. Bring a side out of exile, Black Panthers got crooked politicians walking single file. Rally up the troops from Domino Games corners and stoop shit. Some put down your two-way and connect to this lyrical fiber optic shit. Some damn, a brother need to start making some plan shit.
And then I had always said that my dream was to be a VJ.
Yeah.
And you know what the funny thing about interviews is? It forces you to like reflect on how you got to where you are. And it's literally like therapy. And you're just like, I guess, okay, well, all right, universe, you know what you're doing. Like, I remember Caduce was a host on TRL.
Yeah.
And I had run into Caduce at a poetry show. And I was like, Caduce, you know, I'm a fan. And I want to be on MTV. And I need you to help me get there. And he was like, all right. And it took 2 years. But he would, like, whenever there was an opportunity, he would tell me and share it with me. Mm-hmm. And then one day I ran into him at a Kanye pre-MAGA Kanye show. And he was like, oh, we're casting. I'm going to get you a meeting.
Yeah.
And within 2 weeks, I had the job. Wow. I mean, I had a meeting. Let me not mislead. I had a meeting. I had 2 auditions. But I kept a good relationship with him, you know. I think people think that it's like who you know, but it's not just who you know. It's like how you know them and like what they know about what you do.
Yeah.
And I've been able to be successful in this industry because enough people know who I really am and what I really can do.
What came first, being the job as a VJ or starting the master's program at Columbia? Because I'm fascinated that you did that you did it at the same time and decided to do them at the same time. So how did that happen?
I mean, they literally came at the same time. I got booked to do MTV in March of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
I started grad school that fall. I didn't get accepted to grad school until the summer because there was a glitch in the matrix and they had not sent out any acceptance letters. So my whole class, like my first year class at Columbia's Institute for Research in African American Studies, like we didn't find out that we were in the program until a month before school started.
That's bizarre. They just didn't realize that they didn't send them out? I mean, well, how's that possible?
It was literally like, well, you know how that's possible because like departments don't communicate.
Yeah.
So like they send their things to these people who then send it to these people, and then admissions does whatever they do. And then they're over here planning and planning and planning, and they're like, something's not right.
It's weird. No one has accepted their...
No one's like... And I think, you know what it was, though? Some people had accepted because they had called.
Oh, okay.
I just assumed I didn't get in and left it at that. And so then when they did their due diligence, it was like, oh, shucks. Like, there's a bunch of people that, like, didn't receive their letters.
Yeah.
So I had to like scramble to come up with $32,000 in a month, which at that time, I mean, I don't know what inflation is, but at that time it felt like $1 million, you know, so.
Coming up, Amanda describes what it felt like to land her own HBO special just a few years into performing stand-up comedy.
My mom and I had to scramble for loans and stuff like that, but I got there and it was one of the just really greatest experiences of my life.
Yeah, and it's still, I mean, it's, you reference it in the book a lot, and it's something that seems like it really has stuck with you, what you learned there.
I mean, honestly, like, I'm one of the people who I'm so ardent about, like, trying a college education because I know for me, like, my college education is much in part why I am the kind of person, or I won't even say the kind of person, but why I am the creative I am today. Like, my creativity, I'm very proud of its depth and what it's rooted in and what its foundation is. And that really is a desire for it to not just serve me artistically, but to serve the people, like, socially and radically. And I 1,000% attribute that to my education at Purchase and at Columbia.
I love the chapter of your book where you talk about starting to become a comedian because it did come late in life for you. I mean, not late in life, but late in your career. And you've only been doing it, what, for how?
2013.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, six years or so.
Yeah. My anniversary is November 6th.
So how did you, and you also say that you were not scared to get up on stage to tell jokes, maybe because you had the experience of performing already?
Yeah, I mean, I was scared to bomb.
Yeah.
But I wasn't scared to try.
Yeah.
but yeah, because I'd been hosting for so long, you know, like, and not just hosting like on television, but like hosting like live shows, like, and I hosted the Roots Picnic for years. So I'm not necessarily like shy about being on stage and engaging with a crowd, but it was a process, you know, to find my voice.
Yeah.
You know,
what was the revelation for you that you wanted to do comedy?
Well, I've been getting just a lot of, I was just getting frustrated with people. Like, I knew that I needed to get out of the music space because I knew that that wasn't the space for me anymore. But I didn't know where to go next. And I would communicate with different people who would tell me different things. You know, like, I remember distinctly Nick Cannon saying, like, why aren't you back in TV? You know, and me being like, I mean, that's, like, you make it sound like it's, like, just, like, knocking on a door and walking through. And I just felt like I didn't have, like, a trajectory to get there. And when I really started exploring, like, what my actual pieces on the table like look like compared to others, I started comparing just different careers that I knew. So I looked at like Chelsea Handler, like I always say, like Chelsea Handler, Ellen, and Chris Rock. I looked at their careers and was like, what do they have that I don't have? Because they have careers that I aspire to.
Yeah.
And all of them had stand up. And that was the one thing I didn't have that all of them had. And I kind of just knew, like, if you're going to put yourself in this comedy space in a legitimate way, then you can't, like, you're going to need to also be, like, funny on stage in, like, a real way. Like, you can't just be an comic. Like, you're going to need to be exceptional.
What do you remember about the first time you got on stage sort of as a comedian?
I just remember being like, oh, this feels right.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't really that different than what you do in a daily life. But I was really fortunate to be just in front of a warm crowd. And I just remember being surprised that what I thought, not necessarily surprised, but excited that, like, what I thought was funny, they thought was funny.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, to this day, like, you just never know, as you know from last night's performance.
Was there a bit or a joke that was like the first one that you really felt like worked well in different rooms and for different audiences, something that just like was consistent?
I had this joke about GPS and about how like I would, my GPS would be more effective if it like spoke to me a certain way. And that joke ended up getting me like to NBC stand-up diversity finals, and you know, it ended up being very well appreciated. I do not remember it at all. I'm sure it's somewhere on YouTube. But that was like the first one that I feel like people were really like responsive to that made me say like, oh, I guess I can write jokes. But you know, the corner that I turned eventually was that like, you can't just write things that are funny things. Like, it needs to be funny for you as well. Because sometimes I'll sit and I'll be like, oh, this could be funny. Oh, that could be funny. And it feels very technical. It's like science, you know? And that's why when I get on stage and do it, people are like, well, that is not funny. Because so much of my humor comes not just in like the actual things being said, but how it's being said, the intonation, the intention behind it, et cetera. So if I'm just saying it because this seemed like it would be funny, it's going to fall flat.
Yeah, or maybe it would be funny with in someone else's voice.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, but for you have your own voice and you have to write to your own voice.
And I remember like writing a joke and then like watching a stand-up special. And I cannot remember the comic's name like off the top of my head, but I just remember it was like a older like white woman mom, and like her premise was the same as my premise, and I was like, okay, well, we've got to figure this out now.
That's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem, because like how? But that's how, like, you know, some things are just funny in general, but it's like, how would you talk about this in an Amanda way versus in just like a funny way?
You talk a little bit in the book about being part of this big SNL search for black female cast members at a time when they hadn't had any in a long time.
Well, that's how I started stand-up.
Yeah. So, I mean, so can you talk about that a little bit more? How did you hear about that, and sort of what were your thoughts about that whole controversy at the time?
Well, it's funny because, like, Keenan is essentially, like, how that all started, and Keenan is now, like, that's my booski. Keenan's just like the best ever.
Keenan Thompson is now, he's the longest running cast member on the show. And I think everyone loves him. I mean,
Bring the Funny with me.
Yeah.
But at that time, black women were not feeling him.
Were you not feeling him at the time?
I think that it's not important to say I wasn't feeling him. All the black women were not feeling him. Let's not single me out.
Yeah.
Because I think that, and to be honest, in hindsight, I don't know if what he said is really what he said.
Yeah, I mean,
because the fact of the matter is, we've all seen now that, like, you can say something and media will just be like, you know what? This is actually what you said.
Yeah. I mean, I think it got twisted a little bit. I mean, for people who don't know, he said something along the lines of, there hasn't been a black woman who's ready for the show in a while, or something like that.
Yes. And that got, like, interpreted as, like, this idea that, oh, so is he saying that black women aren't good enough for the show?
Yeah.
And that dovetailed into, which I guess is, you know, which is ends up being positive. It dovetailed into a number of, like, black women showcases popping up for the purpose of proving, like, no, we're out here, we're available, we're deep, like, we can come and do this show. Mm-hmm. And that was the first stand-up I ever did. Like, someone was putting together a showcase, and she hit me up and was like, hey, you know, I see you on Best Week Ever and VH1, so would you want to come and do the show? She thought I already did stand-up because I was doing those shows, and those shows were chock full of, like, great stand-ups, like Mike Britt and Nick Grohl and Mulaney.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I ended up doing the lineup, you know, and what's funny is that Sasheer was on that show.
Yeah.
Sasheer was on the show that
Sasheer's
I did.
Zameda,
and she ended up...
She got the job.
Getting the job.
Yeah, and they also hired Leslie Jones at that time as a writer.
As a writer.
And then she ended up on the cast. Yeah.
Yes.
Was it something that you... Was that a show that you, you know, as a kid or growing up, really wanted to be on? Did you ever think that you could be on it?
I'm jumping broccoli. I mean... It's very serious.
Yeah.
My SNL, my 90s SNL obsession, I have VHS tapes to this day of just episodes of SNL. Like, I pretty much can recite, like, I'm pretty sure I can recite, like, all of Eddie Murphy's sketches. Maybe not all, but at least the ones on the greatest hits. Like, you know, I can give you the entire Buckwheat commercial. Welcome up in all the wrong places.
Are you excited for him to host in a few weeks?
I'm excited for anything Eddie Murphy is doing.
Yeah.
So let's just get that out in the open. Like, Eddie Murphy is just the best. And when I met him, he was still the best. And that was like, because, you know, you don't want to meet your heroes.
Yeah.
But coming to America.
Have you seen his new movie yet, Dolomite?
I have not.
It's good, yeah.
My mom saw it and was like, it is so funny. Eddie's back. I was like, he never left. Relax.
Yeah.
But, you know, Eddie is quintessential comedy, you know, and so and SNL of the 90s and the 80s as well. Like, I was a hip hop head and everybody knew that, but a lot of people didn't know that I was a comedy fanatic. Like, I used to carry around Seinfeld's book Sign Language as if it was the Old Testament. Like, I've have several copies because the binding broke.
Yeah.
And, you know, specials and I just was always very into these things. Like, laughing has always been an incredibly, like, important part of my, like, ethos. So, yes, I wanted to be on SNL. At this point now, knowing, like, how I am and how I operate, I don't think it's the work environment that's best suited for me. But I have a number of folks over there that really are doing the damn thing. So shout out to Sam J and Chris Redd and Keenan, who continue to make, you know, make things happen over
there. Yeah, we had Sam J on this podcast a while back. And,
oh, good.
She's
on my podcast coming up.
Oh, nice.
Look at us. Look at you, Sam J. out here podcasting.
So given all that, what did it mean for you to get your own HBO special earlier this year?
I mean, it was incredible. I think I'm just glad it was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, people get things. People get things, and then you're like, well, they got it. It was trash, though. and so for me, it's like, I'm just not a sociopath, man. Like, I just care. Like, I care that I'm making art that people care about.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's this, like, idea that you're just like, I did it and that's all that matters, that I care about it. And it's like, well, you know, I'm not Emily Dickinson. I'm not hiding poems under the mattress. Like, I'm doing this shit because I wanted to connect with you.
But there is a behavior that white women and women who happen to be white are doing. It's an infraction that you're committing on a regular basis that all of us in here would love for you to stop doing. It's plaguing offices everywhere. Please, we beg of you, stop CCing all these unnecessary people on these goddamn emails! Stop! Stop! Why are you sharing on these goddamn emails? She ain't got shit to do with what we're doing over here!
So how did you kind of approach the special or decide what material you wanted in and just how you wanted the whole thing to feel?
I knew that I wanted to do something that was like specifically for black women. I knew that I needed to do something that was like inherently my voice, but that had a certain broadness to the things I was talking about. Like for instance, like my next special will not be that broad. Like my next special is probably going to be something very personal.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I already know the name of my next special, so...
You're going to announce it right here, right now?
I mean, we haven't sold it or anything, but anyone who wants my next special, it's going to be called I'm Not For Everyone.
Okay, yeah.
That's happening. And there'll be a chair on stage, just in case I want to sit and get, you know...
Get real.
Get real. But I just knew... I knew a couple like real things about doing my special. I knew one, that it was like, whoa, you've only been doing this for a very short amount of time and you got a special. So people are going to actually be very, like your peers are going to actually, you know, be very critical, as they should be, of like, well, why the hell she got a special? And two, like me just wanting to prove to myself, like you're ready for this, you know, mm-hmm. that this isn't just a notch on a belt. And a lot of times in this Hollywood town, like we just kind of, the art becomes a backseat to simply just getting accolades. Mm-hmm. And I've had to get real with myself about the fact that like, I don't really care about the accolades as much. I just need the art to be like paramount. And if I get an accolade from that, then so be it. But with this, it's like reverse, right? Like you're given the special and now it's like, you going to accolade this or you going to art this or you going to do both. And I'm just really proud of my special because I feel like it's exactly what I wanted it to be. And yeah. It's so rare that we just get to do that. And I think it's what I wanted it to be because I had a team that really respected my vision and that really gelled with me to like make that come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're shooting season 4 of Insecure now. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about that show because I think it's probably where I first saw you. And I know you've talked about how you feel very different from your character on that show. Is that accurate? Or?
I think I did in the beginning.
Yeah.
I did in the beginning, but the way that they've written Tiffany and the way that she's evolved, I think we've gotten closer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, she at the beginning came off as like a very, it's funny because she comes off in the beginning of the series, she comes off the way that people actually look at me that don't know me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually a very kind of confusing thing. Like I've had people that are like, I literally had somebody say to me on Instagram, like, don't you think it's funny that she feels so comfortable playing a character that's not like herself?
Meaning...
You mean acting? Like, and I think though that really speaks to a thing that I'm noticing in real time, which is people's inability to separate like the real
mm-hmm.
from what they're watching, and not even just like television but like social media is doing this. Like, I've had some stuff happen over, you know, the last year or whatever that I verbalized on social media, and then like close friends didn't feel the need to even say like, are you okay or anything? And when you ask them why, they're like, well, I don't know. I guess I just felt like I was like watching you on TV.
Mm.
Or like
that the social media is a character as well.
But they, it's like, even though they know it's not, it's just mm-hmm. by the nature of the device.
Yeah.
They, or it'll be like, they feel like they talk, or it'll be like, I felt like I spoke to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I get that. You like, you know, you see all these people on social media, you feel like you know them, you feel like you are communicating with them, even if you're not.
And so like they're talking back to the screen, but I'm not out talking back to them.
Yeah.
And so I've seen how that has translated into like people carrying over my character, Tiffany, to me, Amanda, as a person, and like coloring their view of like things I say and things I do with this character that has seems larger than life. And they've do that. They've done that with the show as well. You know, there's certain stuff about the show that has come under fire by people feeling like, well, this needs to be so more real. And it's like, it's TV.
Yeah. Or people get mad at Issa for something her character did.
Yeah. And she's like, it's television. Like, I've had to tell people, like, I've had to stick up for Issa's character several times and be like, it's TV.
Yeah.
It's not, like, it's not, I know that her character and her have the same name, and that can be, I guess, a little confusing, but like, for real, like, the joy of having TV is that we can go into a fantasy space, like, where things don't have to be so perfect and so aligned. And so over the course of the season, like, we've seen my character actually show that in real time, where like she was very like perfect and aligned. And we've seen as the seasons go, like, you know, just things not necessarily be as perfect as she wants them to be, and revealing her truthfulness. And that's me.
I loved the scene in the Coachella episode of you and Issa in the car outside the 7-Eleven.
Oh, when I was acting.
Yeah, when you were acting.
What was wrong?
I don't know. I don't want to be dramatic, but it's like last night and ever since I got pregnant, I just feel so left out. It's like I really pushed myself to party with y'all.
Girl, we just wanted one last hurrah before the baby came.
It's just, everything's different now. Like, we're different now.
We don't have to be. Shit changes all the time. It's, and we'll always be friends.
Yeah, I hope so.
I was so mad because I haven't gotten to do like anything serious, like acting wise, in such a long time, and I blew my tears on the wide shot, and I was so mad.
Well,
so,
I love your performance in that scene, and I think I mean, obviously, it got a lot of praise and attention. I think, and I don't know. I just feel like I heard from a lot of people about that scene. So, can you just talk about what that was like filming in the car with her?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the beauty of Insecure is, like, it's a dramedy, so we do get to have these moments where we can, like, drop in, like, and have a real, like, a real moment. Like, I was watching Pen 15 this morning, and I, like, was crying, and I was like, ooh, they got me with the dramedy.
Yeah, that show's so good.
Oh, man. And, I mean, I'm a Cancer, so there's that, too, but, like, still. You know, because we cry for everything. Like, you know, this water spills, I might cry. But that scene, what I really appreciate, what I'm really glad about, is how many people felt seen by that scene. Like, how many folks who have had kids, like how many women who have gone through this experience felt like they had been seen, and that I could carry the words on the page through performance-wise to make them feel seen. Because it's one thing to write it on the page, but like, if I don't nail the performance, then it just feels hokey and hacky. And so I was really glad that I was able to like bring that realness to life, because I haven't had that experience, and that is acting.
Yeah, where is Tiffany in this new season? What's going on with her? What's the relationship like?
We've got to wait and find out.
I mean, even just, can you talk about sort of where she is at the end of the last season, going into the next season?
Or she's pregnant.
Yeah.
And then she comes into the next season, and she's still pregnant.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you like being having to wear the pregnancy thing?
What's, you know what, like, though? It's actually not bad, because you don't have to like be conscious of like your body in the same way. And like, I'm just like hanging out. Like, and everyone used to make fun of me, you know, because they're like, why are you walking like you're pregnant? Like, I am Daniel Day-Lewis, okay? Like, I'm method. Like, this is where I'm at. Like, no, but when you can't help it. when you're wearing the pregnancy belly, you legit can't help but like sit with your legs all the way open and like hold your back when you get up, like you waddle. But the funniest part was like, you know, what happens on set is like, I'll just take off my belly and like be like, can you hold my pregnancy? And like the people who've actually had a baby are just like, bitch.
Yeah.
I wish it was that easy that I could just take my pregnancy off and hang it up. But it's not. It's not.
Are you still enjoying making the show?
Yeah, I think Insecure is... The characters go on a journey. You know, and I think that it becomes not enjoyable when you feel stagnant. You know, when you feel static and you feel like the writing isn't serving like you as a creative or the character that you've come to know. You know, but I definitely get to like grow with Tiffany and she gets to change and shift. And they are very conscious of that, and I appreciate that.
I know you talked a lot about that Emmy after party drama on your podcast and sort of told the whole story. Are there any updates on that? I mean, how's it been on set since all that went down?
I mean, the beauty is that we're all like professional people who have worked with each other for like four seasons. And I think we all understand that like there aren't even enough black shows for us to even let that scenario bleed over into what we're doing.
Right.
You know, and so I'm fortunate to be able to work with folks who understand that. And I think what a lot of people don't grasp is that like when you're doing television and you're doing like, you know, this work, like you're still at work. So this is what I mean by like people thinking that like what they watch on TV is going to be like the actual of all time. Like we're friends on the show, but even on the show, like their friends have like strained moments and they have like ups and downs, right? Like, so if you're on a set every day for 15 hours a day, like there's going to be those things too. And not just with us on camera, like that happens with the crew, that happens with the writers, like that happens with humans.
Yeah.
You know, so like things happen. It's just that due to media and the internet, we don't respect that in the general sense. We think that everything is like in a vacuum.
Coming up, Amanda reveals what it felt like to confront Caitlyn Jenner for her white privilege in that viral clip from Katy Perry's house. So what I want to do now is do a little bit of a speed round where we talk about some of the stuff from your career that we haven't really delved into yet, and if there's sort of a story or memory that pops to mind that you want to share.
Okay.
So you mentioned deaf poetry, but is there, when you think about your time, you know, working on that, what comes to mind?
I remember getting on the elevator with Badu and being like, I remember Mos Def having to get me into the after party because I was 19. I remember thinking I'm killing it in my Jordache long denim skirt with my one arm frilly top from Rainbow. I remember Kanye West being in the front row. If you watch it, you will see that he's sitting in the front row with his foot on the stage.
Was that intimidating?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't Kanye West. I mean,
he was just some dude.
It was more so like, take your foot off the stage. I remember my roommates from college being sat on stage and just being, and me feeling so much more secure about what I needed to do because like, my girls is right here, like on the stage with me. And I remember Stan Lathan just being so kind. I just really remember him being kind. I remember Russell Simmons being kind, you know, when we were doing that, and me being this young person really trying to just feel like I belonged at a place where like everyone just seemed like so seasoned, you know, and so about this life. And for me, it was like the first step to getting to where I am now.
You do mention a little bit of sexual harassment by Russell Simmons in the book, though, no?
Well, two things can happen.
Yeah.
You can have a good experience with someone and sexual harassment with them as well.
Why did you want to include that in the book?
Because I was talking about sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm. Now it's your experience.
Yep.
nothing else you want to say about that?
I say it in the book. Yeah. You got to read the book.
Got to read the book. Everyone read the book for that. Yeah, I wanted to talk about Smart, Funny, and Black, too, because we haven't really gotten to that yet. And that's your live show that you've been doing for a while. How did that start? And there's also a really fascinating story in the book about trying to maybe turn it into a TV show and that not working
transpiring.
So yeah, I mean, is there, when you think about that whole thing, what do you want to share? What comes to mind, or a story, or just?
Well, Smartphone in Black is really just my like perfect storm of my academic background, my comedic love, and my desire to really help and be a part of like reinforcing community amongst the Black people of this country. And doing so with the best tools I have, which is my creativity and my humor. Mm-hmm. And really just using the power of culture and shared experience to remind folks like why we need to love each other more, why we need to take care of each other more. And not just as people, but like as Black people in America, like it's imperative that we make a shift in this space, because there is such a shift being made to dissolve that anything of that, you know? So that is what Smart Funny and Black at its core is really about. I mean, on the surface level, it's a variety game show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that brings funny people to the stage to playing games that I've written and created that test their knowledge of Black culture, Black history, and the Black experience. And in the meantime of that, we have sing-alongs, and, you know, there's jokes, and there's moments of ebony excellence. Yeah. And when people come to Smart, Funny, and Black, whether it's to be on stage as performers or to be spectators, I mean, the biggest compliment I get is people saying that they left with a new, like, rejuvenance of like hope and joy and pride in not only themselves but in like their Black experience. And I love when people say like, damn, like I was at the show saying to myself like, damn, I need to do more research, like I need to delve more into like my culture. And I just take a really big responsibility. I consider it to be my responsibility as somebody who had like the fortunate nature of like getting to use my higher education to delve more into like my own personal identity, to like bring that to folks who maybe didn't get to do that.
And is there any hope still that it will get to TV, or what do you, how do you think about that now?
The revolution will not be televised.
Yeah.
It will be live.
I wanted to ask about your famous confrontation with Caitlyn Jenner at Katy Perry's dinner party, which is was a crazy thing that happened.
I'm good for famous confrontations, y'all.
Has there been any fallout or updates on that? Have you had any contact with Caitlyn Jenner or anything that sort of come out of that?
Do you feel like she's more aware of her privilege?
Not that I could tell.
Correct. So that's the update on that. The reason I am so passionate, and I'm not hostile, I'm passionate. The reason I am so passionate is because I've had such a different experience in this country than you. Because as a Black woman, the government is so much of my life, and it always has been. Like, the government literally said that Black men couldn't even be in the house or else women could not get welfare. And that's a big reason why there's such a chasm between Black women and Black men in this generation. So I think that there's just a lot to understand for like why people are talking the way they're talking about different things. I understand why you're talking the way you're talking, because I know
I just don't understand. What am I talking? I just said I believe in this country.
Yes.
And you don't?
Can say that in a way that I cannot, because you've had a different experience, because this country is here for you. This country ain't here for me in the same way, sis. It isn't. And you, as a trans person, have to also identify the fact that this country hasn't been here for trans until like maybe 2 o'clock today. I think, you know, one thing I know is that sometimes for the most part, like situations are happening in a multi-layered way.
Mm-hmm.
There's the surface, and that's involving the two people that are there. But then there's also this other layer that's how it affects the people that are witnessing it, you know? And it's the people that are witnessing it in the immediate space, as well as the people who are witnessing it on the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm most proud of with that situation was that I felt like a number of people made it clear to me that them watching me choose to be honest in a space where politeness would have probably been the safer bet empowered them to feel like they had a voice in spaces where they would have been expected to also be polite. And, you know, the thing about me is like that doesn't change. Like, I think some people would rather me just do that in like this space, but it's not okay in that space. Like, if it's okay over there because those are the people who are over there. But over here, if it's going to affect me, then I don't want you to bring that over here. But it's like, I'm a truth teller in any space.
Right.
And I think that if I had asked certain people like how I should go into that room, they would have said, you know, just play it cool. And if I had played it cool, I think I would have been playing myself. Mm-hmm. And that scenario ricocheted and ended up becoming like this iconic moment for a lot of people simply because I said something to someone that they may have wanted to say to that person for a long time, mm-hmm. but never had the access to.
Yeah. So the way we end every episode is by asking comedians, what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? So it could be something you saw on
everything
TV.
Everything Dimitri Martin said last night made me laugh. Like, literally, Dimitri Martin, I love his stand-up. I love his haircut. I love his name. This is the thing. Like, not all comics are funny off stage. Mm-hmm. Like, I think a lot of people may say, like, when you hear me in interviews, I'm not necessarily like funny in interviews, you know, because people always ask me these deep ass questions where I don't get to be funny. I have to be like this introspective guru. But Dimitri Martin, I'm telling you, everything that came out of that man's mouth in that green room last night was hilarious. And I just found myself at a certain point just looking at him, just like, I'm like, you're just funny. You're a funny guy. He's funny. You know, once I move past like laughing and I'm just like, I can't even keep laughing. Like, I'm just impressed, mm-hmm. you know, that really does a lot. So being in the presence of Dimitri Martin and Patton Oswalt last night was like fabulous. And of course, Kevin Nealon. Kevin Nealon's another one. Everything Kevin Nealon says is funny.
Yeah.
Every single thing Kevin Nealon says is funny. I don't even know how it's possible. I aspire, Kevin Nealon, to be as consistently funny as you are. Everything he opens his mouth to say is funny. I don't even understand. It's not even like he's doing a funny voice. So yeah, but in terms of like something public, I would say that's like made me laugh. Jay Versace, who's a young brother, who's a social media influencer, did a video where he's sitting on a couch with this white guy whose name I don't know. I apologize for not knowing this person's name, but they're on a bed. With a big Casio keyboard on their laps. And Jay starts singing, "No weapon formed against me shall prosper." And someone sent that to me knowing like what's been going on, just kind of like me having to deal with the internet's slings and arrows. Like I just feel like I'm Rickon and I'm running from Ramsey. And I'm like, zigzag, Amanda, zigzag! And so someone sent me that video and I just was dying because Jay Versace just warms my soul on a regular basis. And he was just singing it, but he was singing it in the style of like a character in a Tyler Perry play. Mm-hmm. And just all of the elements put together just brought me to a place of joy. So thank you, Jay, for bringing me to joy on such a regular basis.
And thank you, Amanda, for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again so much to Amanda Seals. Go buy her new book, Small Doses, by clicking the link in the show notes for this episode. And look out for season 4 of Insecure coming in 2020. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And please follow Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!
I think we know the rest of the story.